hate-filled war zone, branding the city with a reputation for embracing bigots that resonates with some observers even to this day. The action returned to Marsh Chapel on October 1, 1968. The long, hot summer had drawn to a close, with leaves starting to dot the plaza outside of the church. Inside, approximately 100 students gathered around Raymond Kroll and Thomas Pratt. Both had recently gone AWOL from their military duties. The idea was to protect them in a way that would double as a visible act of protest. The idea of offering sanctuary to AWOL soldiers was a new maneuver for the Vietnam Resistance Movement, a tactic pioneered in May at Arlington Street Church. Few believed it would hold any legal weight, but the symbolic power of the gesture would equal that of dozens of protests. Kroll and Pratt's arrival marked the first time Marsh Chapel was used as such a sanctuary. At the end of the first night, something strange happened. Private Pratt donned a disguise and escaped via the chapel's rear door, claiming he'd been manipulated. Kroll remained, telling reporters, "The Resistance and the School of Theology are not using me in any way for anybody's gain except mine." Was it all a complex stunt to make the Resistance look bad? Would Kroll follow Pratt? Over the next few days, more students arrived. A cafeteria and medical station materialized, while rock bands played in the same basement where Leary and his crew tried to attain the divine via chemicals. By Wednesday, 1,000 people were protecting Kroll at Marsh Chapel. From the pulpit, Howard Zinn expressed his support for the ongoing free speech exercise, wondering if the chapel's role as a safe haven might become permanent. As cop cars repeatedly cruised down Commonwealth Avenue to keep an eye on the situation, Kroll's lawyer announced inside that his client wanted to be taken out physically as a symbolic act. Early Sunday morning, FBI agents entered Marsh Chapel to find young people sleeping in the pews. "This is the FBI," an agent barked, as others swarmed the church looking for Kroll. "We will give you 15 seconds to clear the aisle." Kroll, a scrawny 18-year-old, went limp. But the agents grabbed hold of him as if he were a wild bull. Outside, a Liberation News Service photographer snapped a stunning shot of Kroll, his face in agony, his shirt ripped to shreds. The agents on the left and right of Kroll looked away, but the one up front, an older man in a black Stetson, smiled as he wrenched Kroll's hand. By the following week, the photo was etched into the heads of resistors nationwide. The incident broke activist Alex Jack's patience and perhaps his sanity. The sanctuary at Marsh Chapel has shown simply that there can be no sanctuary from oppression, from racism, from militarism, he wrote in the BU News. No place is sacred. Forget about incremental progress. For Jack, it was time for a revolution, the birth of a new society where exploitation is structurally impossible, where power is returned and exercised by the people, where there is no distinction between religion, politics, or art, where, in short, there are no sanctuaries because no one is oppressed. From Timothy Leary's Good Friday experiment to the celebration and mourning of Martin Luther King, from the fantastic visions of Russell H. Greenan to the broken sanctuary for two deserters, Marsh Chapel is one of those landmarks that seem to act as a lightning rod during this wrenching time in the nation's life. Sometimes advocates for peace are killed. Sometimes it seems like you can communicate directly with God, or that maybe you are God. Sometimes you refuse to fight, but the war comes to you anyway. "Rise up," Alex Jack wrote in the wake of Raymond Kroll's capture, "and utterly destroy this universe." Chapter 11. We have all been astrals many times. A week before, members of the Fort Hill community and Avatar staff turned a Club 47 benefit show into a chair-smashing, face-punching disaster. The underground newspaper suddenly announced that Mel Lyman would no longer write for the newspaper. In the previous issue, the letters to Mel section was half praise, half questioning his claim to being God. Business as usual. The issue even ended with an uncharacteristically sweet Lyman poem about hope for the future. So it came as a shock to readers when they opened issue 22 to see the news, along with Lyman's last "To All Who Would Know" piece, below the spookiest photo of him yet. "I am going to burn down the world. I am going to tear down everything that cannot stand alone. I am going to turn ideals to shit. I am going to shove hope up your ass. I am going to reduce everything that stands to rubble, and then I am going to burn the rubble. And then I am going to scatter the ashes, and then maybe someone will be able to see something as it really is. Watch out." On the same page as the announcement was the self-referential declaration, "But Mel Lyman is the Avatar." It was a perplexing move. Why would the Fort Hill community sabotage its one reliable, popular form of communication? The FHC still boasted about what they were going to produce. One follower stated that their company, United Illuminating, would one day be the only company in the entire world building model cities for a new world and making the stars shine at night. But outside of Avatar, they had little to show for their grand ambitions. Lyman kept referencing films he was about to make and release, but the public never saw them. When it came to music, one of the group's undeniable talents, they pursued concerts and recordings in an odd manner as well. When audiences showed up to hear the Lyman family's music, they could instead be subjected to a dialogue with the audience until Queskin and Lyman felt confident that the audience was really present, really open-hearted, and ready for whatever was to happen, as Kindman wrote in his memoir. The music thus became a reward for the audience for making the musicians feel welcomed and understood spiritually. Unsurprisingly, fights broke out at these shows. People from all over the world had been showing up on Fort Hill to check out the scene. But as Mel's fame grew, protective measures became necessary. He was never in the Avatar office. As editor Charles Giuliano put it, Lyman's contributions were done by remote control. Not all of Avatar's writers cared for this setup. One day in the late spring of 1968, according to a Fusion piece about the FHC, a powerfully built black man who wrote under the name of Pebbles made his way to the top of Fort Hill and demanded to see Mel. No one could stop him, and he went right to Mel's house and knocked on the door. Everyone I asked about Pebbles' full name had no clue. He was just Pebbles. Jesse Benton answered, and the two argued. The Avatar contributor told Jesse Benton that he was God, more powerful than Mel Lyman. This incident upset Jesse and Mel. Some attributed Lyman's messianic turn to his relationship with Jesse, who took on a similar role her mother had played in protecting her husband, Thomas Hart Benton's time and talents. Ex-jug band member Maria Muldaur summed it up. Mel had many old ladies in his life, but it was when she was with him that it really started being the inner circle and the outer peons. And you couldn't get in to see Mel, and things got more and more mysterious. Some believed that what happened next was due to a dream their leader had, but it was most certainly a reaction to Pebbles' visit. Mel ordered the Fort Hill community to cease all other activities, including work on Avatar, and construct a wall around his house. Mike Bloomfield visited the Hill while they were building the wall, I'm told, during my tour of the Fort Avenue Terrace houses, and he pitched in and helped them out. Staring at the symbolic and functional construction, it boggles the mind to think that the guitarist from Bob Dylan's infamous Newport concert, the man who appears on the recording of Like a Rolling Stone, helped lay the bricks. The people outside of Fort Hill were thrown into turmoil, Paul Mills wrote in Fusion. They had obligations to advertisers. They had articles and news to publish. But the Fort Hill editors had abandoned Avatar. The wall stands to this day. When Avatar No. 24 arrived in late April, there was no news section, just the inner magazine that included all of the FHC's content, which for this issue comprised page after page of photos of Alice and Pepper on LSD. Kindman, one of the few community members with actual experience publishing an underground newspaper, recalled it being a declaration of spiritual war by Mel. On the cover, under a photo of 14 men proudly standing by their work in progress, was an ominous note. "You know what we've been doing up here on Fort Hill. We've been building a wall around Mel's house out of heavy, heavy stone." The issue represented Mel and the FHC thumbing their noses at the other members of the Avatar Alliance, challenging them to get with the Hill's program or split, Kinman wrote. Tensions between the Hill and Valley people, non-family members who worked on Avatar, had been building for months. Pebbles and the stone wall brought things to a head. Even outside of the controversial expanding Lyman coverage in Avatar, Charles Giuliano noted how difficult it was to keep their readers happy. "The resistance wants us to be a radical paper. The artists want us to be lewd and lascivious. The musicians want us to put down the Boston sound, while others think we should talk more about drugs." A meeting was called on the Hill. Around a large table at 4 Fort Avenue Terrace, the two parties gathered to discuss the goal of the newspaper. Charles Giuliano represented the Valley contingent, and Mel Lyman, of course, spoke for the Hill people. Here were two old friends who had gone on road trips together, once shared the same girlfriend, and reached astronomical levels of intoxication together at 23 Kenwood, now facing each other as bitter opponents. The entire meeting was being recorded. "I was struck by the intensity of the conversation and the emotions being exchanged," Kinman recalled, "and by the seeming contempt in which the non-Hill people were being held. There seemed to be no room for compromise." There was no compromise, but there was a capitulation. The Valley writers could continue publishing a newspaper, but they couldn't call it Avatar. That was fine with Giuliano, who went immediately to work on non-Avatar. Issue 25 ended up containing all the best elements of the news section of Avatar. An article on Boston's controversial urban development plan, a think piece titled, "What is the Underground?" News about Roxbury and Somerville, as well as an article by William Andrews, wherein he dispelled common myths about drugs. The cover had no logo or title, but Ed Beardsley decided to place a reversed Avatar logo on the inside cover. Readers who held the paper up to the light would see it seep through, winking that the publication was still secretly the one and only Avatar. "Mel was furious," Michael Kindman recalled. "In retaliation, he ordered his boys to take action. This was war." Up on the Hill, David Goud had a plan. The FHC should seize the unauthorized avatars before they hit the streets. The heist kicked off at 4:30 a.m. on May 11th. A run of 45,000 issues had just arrived at 37 Rutland Street, the bundle still warm from the presses, according to family member Brian Keating. Inside, the only staff present was Pebbles, who was either working late or living at the office. Pebbles stalled the Fort Hill mob, but eventually they loaded the papers into their cars. Charles Giuliano notified the police, who laughed when they heard what had happened to his precious underground newspaper. The fleet of Fort Hill cars zoomed back to Highland Park, where every faux avatar was locked up inside the Kachichuit standpipe. Giuliano was devastated. For the better part of a week, there were negotiations, threats, scenes, Giuliano told Rolling Stone. Fort Hill invited us all up for a big steak dinner at Jim Queskin's house, and we tried to iron it all out. But the outcome of this meeting had already been determined by Mel Lyman. As the two parties argued, Kindman and some other FHC members removed Issue 25 from the tower and sold it for scrap paper, converting an expensive print into $35. At the end of dinner, the downtown editors were informed about what had just happened to Issue 25. The message was clear. If the Lyman family wasn't going to be part of Avatar, there would be no Avatar. After consulting the paper's original charter, the Valley team's lawyers saw a clear path to victory. We called a board meeting, Dave Wilson says, and simply voted the entire staff out. The Fort Hill contingent didn't object and begged Wilson not to subpoena Mel, as it would constitute a parole violation. Wilson and Giuliano were legally allowed to continue to publish a paper called Avatar without input from Fort Hill. After slaving over the first issue of the new paper for weeks, Ed Beardsley, livid that he had been passed over for the lead role in Zabriskie Point in favor of Mark Frechette, destroyed the entire ready-to-print newspaper overnight. Just how much of his action was fueled by anger about Zabriskie's casting, and how much might have been secret revenge instructions from Mel Lyman cannot be determined. Beardsley was the perfect double agent for Mel. He didn't know who he was from day to day, Giuliano comments. Ed Beardsley would have to settle for the role he did finally land. In 1971, he was cast in a made-for-public television movie starring David Silver and directed by Fred Barzyk, entitled America, Inc. America, Inc. is an odd, ahead-of-its-time meta-movie that combines scripted scenarios and documentary footage, and perhaps most surprisingly is constructed as a way to show what happened to popular Boston TV host David Silver after What's Happening, Mr. Silver was canceled. Even director Fred Barzyk appears on camera early on, shocked to see just how dropped out Silver has become since their collaboration on the show together. Silver leaves his wife, Karen, and embarks on a road trip with Ed Beardsley to find himself and discover the country. The soundtrack is provided by, you guessed it, Mel Lyman. A new song, River, has since emerged on a bootleg release entitled Birth. Over the end credits, as if the music selection had been made last minute or an argument had arisen over it, you hear Fred Barzyk overdub an announcement. Theme music courtesy of the Lyman family. Giuliano and Wilson laboriously removed the crumpled layout from the trash and slowly recreated it. It was not a great artistic triumph, but we did it, Giuliano told Rolling Stone. We did it. We did the fucking paper. Some referred to it as Avatar 2, or the Boston Avatar. And if you didn't know any better, you might have thought it was business as usual, judging from the front cover during its 6-issue run that summer. Inside, however, was all news, no Mel. Wilson thought they were the best issues they ever did, serving the community at large. Dave Wilson quit Avatar 2 in the early summer of 1968 to refocus on Broadside of Boston, the long-running music publication that was a model for Paul Williams' Crawdaddy. Wilson never fell in line with the worship of Mel Lyman like Crawdaddy's Williams did, but he holds no grudges. I think of Mel rather fondly, Wilson says, laughing. But I didn't agree with 99% of what he was up to. When Wilson left Avatar 2, he sent Lyman a letter explaining that the struggle was over and wishing him good luck. Days later, two of Lyman's foot soldiers appeared at Wilson's door with a crystal decanter of marijuana as a peace offering. Mel said that was the most spiritual letter he's ever received, one of the men told Wilson. I heard the rumors, Wilson says, that maybe Mel didn't actually die. I really don't know. He was always a really gaunt, ascetic-looking person. I'd guess he died, perhaps from diabetic causes. With Wilson gone, Giuliano couldn't keep Avatar 2 afloat much longer. He agrees with Wilson's guess that their former friend died of complications from diabetes. I could be wrong, Giuliano says, but Mel was into total self-indulgence. If there's something that's taboo, do it to the max. His idea of a really good time was to sit there and eat a pound of fudge. Mel could eat a pound of fudge, and so at some point he lost all his teeth. And so I think he probably abused his body in a way that caught up with him. Starting in October 1968, a new glossy magazine from the FHC arrived. American Avatar made no pretense of covering local politics, but did run a fair amount of national political content, filtered through what family members called Hill philosophy. Today, the great people are the musicians, the actors, the filmmakers, the communicators, Lyman declared in the first issue. The spirit that begat this country is playing a new instrument. Let the Nixons and Humphreys and Wallaces keep house for us. We have a lot of work to do. The Fort Hill community tried to expand their audience beyond Boston, passing the magazine out to festival-goers at Woodstock. But American Avatar folded after four issues. Without a print outlet, things got weirder on the Hill. Around this time, the Lyman family made its first appearance in a book, though the names were all changed. Henry Gross's 1968 The Flower People took readers on a tour of hippie commune America. For the Fort Hill section, Mel Lyman is renamed David Lynch. It is a paramountly happy tribe, with David Lynch, its godlike guiding chief, smaller family subdivisions within it, and single individuals in unaffiliated abundance. 7 years later, the mother of FHC's Faith Goud, Kay Boyle, published The Underground Woman, 1975, a novel in which Lyman family members also appear under new names. The leader is Pete the Redeemer, who would be acknowledged the greatest folk singer since Woody Guthrie, and his albums would outsell even Dylan's. Increasingly, Lyman dictated his followers' sleeping, bathing, and sexual schedules. One day, all the Tauruses would be asked to leave the Hill. The next, a prohibition on having children would be announced. Mel was making plans to accelerate the rate of change on the Hill, to intensify the internal struggle each of us was going through, Kinman wrote. We found clues everywhere. When the Beatles' White Album arrived later that year, Kinman and his friends swore they heard a message buried in the garbled collage of Revolution Number 9. Here's to Mel, King of the World. With American Avatar behind them, the Lyman family returned to music. They attempted to record something to set the new band apart from the jug band legacy. In late July 1969, Lyman and Queskin asked their old bandmates Maria and Jeff Muldaur to put down some vocals at Petrucci and Atwell Studios on Newbury Street, not far from WBCN's headquarters. They recorded a transcendent version of Curtis Mayfield's People Get Ready, with the Muldaur's vocals bringing tears to Mel's eyes. The rekindling of this creative collaboration was short-lived, as Maria and Jeff were given a hard sell to join the FHC later that same night. Hey, I love Mel because he's a great guy, not because he's God, Jeff explained. The room went deathly silent. The Muldaurs were not invited back. The other acts working at Petrucci and Atwell knew to keep their distance from the Fort Hill community singers. According to musician David Palmer, the Lyman crowd took over the studio while he was working on material there with his old friend Rick Philp, who was briefly Van Morrison's first Boston guitarist in 1968. Women from the FHC began hanging around, charming the entire staff, Palmer says of the Lymans. They wanted nothing but their music recorded there. Freaked out, Palmer and Philp went elsewhere, but things would soon get far worse for Philp. On May 24, 1969, a few weeks after performing with Van Morrison at the Ark Club, Rick Philp went to a house on Beacon Street to retrieve a few of his guitars that had gone missing. He was never seen alive again. Philp and Palmer had known each other since their high school days in Warren, New Jersey, where they started a group called the Middle Class. If the name sounds familiar, it's because they were the headlining band at the 1965 concert that would mark the Velvet Underground's first show ever, an 8 p.m. engagement at a school gym in Summit, New Jersey. Ticket price $2.50. The unlikely pairing was facilitated by Al Aronowitz, who managed both bands. He was new to the job, but not to the music world. A longtime New York Post music critic, Aronowitz introduced Bob Dylan to the Beatles and was present at the basement tapes sessions. As for the Middle Class, Aronowitz's babysitter had told him about them. A few months before the Summit High show, Aronowitz introduced the young band to husband and wife songwriting team Carol King and Jerry Goffin, and together they started cutting tracks. Their music had an edgy sense of urgency, King wrote in her memoir, A Natural Woman, raving about Philp's inventive guitar parts, and the band's raw but unmistakable talent. On the first single, Free as the Wind, King and Goffin shared writing credits with young Philp and Palmer. New label, new group, and new Goffin-King material has smash hit possibilities, Billboard raved. Folk rocker is a powerhouse. Aronowitz sent the Middle Class out on the road when he could, which tightened up an already powerful live band. But for all its talent, the Middle Class kept missing their big break. The band was just not going to work, and we could feel it, Palmer said in 2015. Carol and Jerry were having problems in their relationship. It was just bad, bad timing for everybody concerned. Philp enrolled at Emerson College in Boston, and Palmer followed in the summer of 1968. Handsome, polite, and thoughtful, Rick Philp hadn't let his band's flirtation with fame go to his head. Because of his father's pressure to pursue a business career, his wardrobe consisted mostly of suits. Beneath the bourgeois trappings was a phenomenal guitarist. The deep love for writing and playing music that possessed him was impenetrable, his girlfriend Kathy West later wrote. No one involved recalls how Rick Philp was introduced to the ex-singer of Them, but by March 1968, he was rehearsing with a short-lived Boston combo, the first of three that Van Morrison fronted during his Bay State exile. Bassist Tom Kilbanya remembers being impressed that Philp had recorded demos for the Monkees and felt he was a good fit. A memory from Philp's Emerson College girlfriend Elaine Kessler suggests that, although their collaboration was brief, Philp and Morrison had struck up some kind of friendly rapport. For instance, the night Martin Luther King was assassinated, she remembers being at Van Morrison's Green Street apartment with Rick and watching TV coverage of the riots while they all sat on Morrison's bed in shock. For this lineup, Morrison used a rehearsal room at the National Express recording studio in the South End. June Benson, who lived above the studio, remembers hearing Morrison before she saw him. The music was daily. Brown-Eyed Girl played almost endlessly that summer, she says. We would try and talk over it, clean the house with it blaring, eat with it blasting. It was just never-ending when Van was there. This first Boston band, Philp, Kilbanya, and a forgotten drummer played one confirmed show. Morrison's first live appearance in Boston, Spring Sing, in front of what would be one of his largest audiences for the entire year. It was also the first show in which Morrison used the enigmatic moniker, the Van Morrison Controversy. In Dick Iacovello's pictures of the band, a long-haired Morrison, resplendent in a multicolored striped suit and tie, commands the stage. At times, he even smiles. Rob Norris, a middle-class fan and future member of a Lou Reed-less VU, was bowled over by the show, comparing the sound to Van's Blowin' Your Mind. After the semester ended, Rick Philp chose working with Carole King over Van Morrison. He and his roommate, Harvey Dog Alter, made the long drive to Los Angeles together. King had rented a house in Laurel Canyon for Philp, Alter, and Kathy. During the summer in L.A., it became increasingly clear to Kathy that Harvey was growing a little too possessive of Rick. After the first night, Harvey scolded the reunited couple for keeping their door closed. Later, Harvey told Rick and Kathy a disturbing story from his summer restaurant job, in which he witnessed a meat slicer blade decapitate the operator. He smiled as he recounted the incident, the truth of which they couldn't determine. Back in Boston in late 1968, there were two mysterious fires in Rick and Harvey's apartment. Trying to stay positive, Rick noted to Kathy that the guitars were undamaged. The arson squad found evidence that the fires were purposely set. The following spring, the guitarist moved to Brighton to distance himself from Harvey Alter. Philp's letters to Kathy depict someone trying to keep his head above water. Even good news was immediately followed by a sense of sinking hope. "I'm playing with Van Morrison May 1st, he wrote, noting in the same letter that his father had told him to get a real job, to stop being so dirty and disgusting. Kathy recalls the most heartbreaking line, "That crap about people are basically honest and really want some kind of meaningful relationships with other people is just bullshit." Shortly after the letter was mailed, Rick's guitars were mysteriously stolen. Fed up with Boston, he made plans to get to L.A. as soon as the semester ended. The date, May 1st, refers to Van Morrison's three-night stand at the Ark, a new club on Lansdowne Street meant to compete with the Boston Tea Party. Fort Hill community member John Kostick had created a gigantic version of one of his Buckminster Fuller-inspired metal star sculptures to hang from the ceiling inside the Ark. Smaller versions were churned out in Kostick's Roxbury workshop and sold by FHC members. Decades later, a Kostick star appeared on an MIT professor's desk in the film Good Will Hunting. In May 1969, underneath a giant spinning Kostick star, Van Morrison performed Astral Weeks in its entirety during one, if not all three, of these concerts, something he wouldn't do again until 2008 at the Hollywood Bowl. Kilbanya was still on bass at this point, with John Platania on guitar, Bob Mason on drums, and flutist saxophonist Graham Blackburn. Philp and Astral Weeks alum John Payne appeared as special guests. Confirmed audience members included Jonathan Richman and Peter Wolfe. Soon after this show, most of the Astral Weeks songs would be excised from Morrison's set list, rarely or never to be performed for another 40 years. Sometime during the week of May 19th, Philp received a phone call from Alter. Harvey said he'd found Rick's guitars, and if he came by their old basement apartment at 233 Beacon Street, he could take them back. Within a few days, some of Philp's classmates and professors noticed he was missing. Rick had mentioned to a friend that he was going to Harvey's apartment to retrieve his guitars. This information was passed along to detectives. 5 days after that attempt to retrieve his instruments, police entered Alter's apartment to find Rick's decomposing corpse under some blankets on Alter's bed. "He's dead," Harvey Alter told the officers. "I killed Rick. He was 22 years old." The medical examiner called it a complex homicide, involving multiple blows to the head, a broken chair leg, and a length of rope. Rick's history professor, John Coffey, recalls the story that eventually emerged. Harvey Alter had had a crush on Rick, who wasn't gay. Yet so long as Harvey didn't come on to him, Rick didn't see a problem. But he started coming on to Rick. So Rick moved, and Harvey said, "You know, if I can't have him, nobody can." His lawyer devised an elaborate defense, proposing that the two young men had taken drugs and engaged in consensual sex. Things had gotten out of hand, the lawyer said, as the drugs, it's never clear which ones, kicked in. Kathy and others close to Rick saw this as pure fabrication. Rick was only an occasional marijuana user and had never displayed any bisexual tendencies. After 2 weeks of testimony, the judge accepted a plea of the lesser charge of manslaughter on Alter's behalf, citing the drug use as a major factor in his decision. "It is unfortunate that so many of our young people who have a chance to gain an education spill it down the drain by the use of illegal drugs," the judge declared, adding in a bizarre aside that he wished more college students would attend murder trials to witness real tragedies instead of going to see the musical Hair. In Van Morrison's evolving Boston lineup, the teenage John Sheldon replaced Rick Philp sometime in May 1968. I ask Sheldon if, in a way, it makes sense that Morrison rejected the frenetic electric version of the songs that Sheldon was pushing that summer in an attempt to create shelter in his otherwise turbulent situation. Sheldon says, "He was looking for something in the music. He was searching for something, and he wasn't getting it with the rock and roll thing." Producer Louis Marinstein heard this searching, this quest, in September 1968, when Van's audition of Astral Weeks at A Studio stunned him to the core. He tells me this repeatedly over the phone, then even more emphatically when we meet outside a coffee shop near his home in Manhattan. In aviator glasses and black baseball cap, the 80-year-old Marinstein seems tall even though he never gets up from his motorized scooter. His voice is frail, and I lean forward to catch his words. In the live room at A Studio, Marinstein wasn't even certain that Morrison understood what he was singing about. It was like hearing something being poured out of the man's subconscious. Marinstein said to his partner, Bob Schwade, "Bob, what are we wasting time for? Let's go make a record." The three drove to New York City that same night, he says. En route, Marinstein tried to tell Morrison about some of the bands and albums he had worked with previously. He wasn't impressed, so I stopped talking. They deposited the singer at a hotel, and the three arranged to meet at Schwade and Marinstein's Midtown office in the morning. This would be the first time Morrison had returned to New York since fleeing earlier in 1968. I won't go into details, but I think it's sufficient to say Burt Burns and Bang was a fucked-up bad scene, Morrison once wrote to a musician friend. Was he nervous that Carmine Wassel DeNoia might come around? When he arrived at the office the next day, he needed a drink. "There's never a drink with Van," Marinstein says. I don't know how long we were there, but he finally got talking about his music. They discussed who would play on the album. Morrison suggested his Boston musicians, but Marinstein opposed the idea. "We had a fight over it," he says, "but I had more conviction about why it should be my way." A compromise was reached. Marinstein would choose the musicians, but Morrison could bring Tom Kilbanya and John Payne from Boston to New York. They wouldn't play on the record, but Warner Brothers would pay them to attend the sessions, out of courtesy, and in case something about their arrangements needed clarification. The next day, Morrison came to Marinstein's office and played him all the potential songs for the record. Was Merenstein surprised that it was so different from Brown-Eyed Girl? "Everything he did surprised me," he says. "It was just him and a guitar. It was so awesome, I can't even tell you how moved I felt by his ability to communicate." Upon first hearing the song Moondance, Merenstein briefly considered including it on the album, but it was too warm, too lovey for Astral Weeks. Merenstein contacted jazz bass player Richard Davis to book him for the project and to explain to him the other musicians he wanted present at the sessions, some by name, some just by referencing the instrument and feel he wanted. Merenstein and Davis became close friends in the ensuing decades. But when the producer speaks about Davis's musicianship, he still sounds worshipful. Davis's playing is the foundation that the earth is floating on. The first session was booked for September 25, 1968, at Century Sound Studios on 135 West 52nd Street. Before the first note was committed to tape, Payne and Kilbanya knew they wouldn't be on the record. "I'm sorry, Tom, I really am," Morrison said, in an unusual show of emotion. Kilbanya was upset by the news, but there was some consolation in learning that his replacement was Richard Davis. "I idolized him at that time," the former Berklee music student says. "I was a freaking jazz musician, after all." If the two Bostonians had a loose plan to talk their way onto the record, Tom's chances were dashed the moment Davis walked in the door. For John, there was still hope. The studio filled up with Merenstein's chosen team. Davis on bass, Jay Berliner on guitar, Connie Kay on drums, and Warren Smith Jr. on vibraphone, all respected jazz musicians. A New York flute player who appears on two tracks goes unnamed in the liner notes, and none of the musicians can recall who it was. In the control room, Brooks Arthur, the engineer and owner of Century Sound Studios, manned the boards, while Merenstein stood behind him. Payne and Kilbanya sat on the couch, watching. It was dusk as they tuned up their instruments. Most of them had already worked a session or two earlier that day. Consulting his work diary from that year, guitarist Jay Berliner notes he had just recorded jingles for both Noxzema and Pringles potato chips before showing up to start working on one of the most celebrated albums of all time. There was no project title yet. Berliner's gig diary merely says Van Morrison. None of the musicians had heard of him before. Precisely 1 week before the first Astral Week session, Jay Berliner recorded guitar for a band called The Astral Projection, who were cutting an album titled The Astral Scene. Surprisingly, the record is not psychedelic in any musical sense, but rather a brand of blandly sunny pop, with titles and lyrics that occasionally evoke New Age beliefs. The singer concludes the final track by singing, "Was it just a dream, the astral scene?" Between this forgettable astral record and Astral Weeks, the industrious Berliner also recorded jingles for Eastern Airlines and a few songs with Dionne Warwick. Berliner remembers the unusual way the band was introduced, or not introduced, to the star of the project. This little guy walks in, past everybody, disappears into the vocal booth, and almost never comes out, he said. Even on the playbacks he stayed in there. The other musicians confirm this. Davis, now retired and living in Wisconsin, focuses on what he found important about the sessions. "Well, I was with three of my favorite fellas to play with, so that's what made it beautiful. We were not concerned with Van at all. He never spoke to us." Van's default mode of non-interaction was familiar to his Boston bandmates, but this level of shyness was extreme. "He seemed spaced out," Payne told biographer Clinton Halen, "as though he was in a lot of personal pain. Perhaps in the presence of players who were part of the modern jazz quartet, or Charles Mingus collaborators, Morrison simply became overwhelmed by nerves. His old producer, Bert Burns, had always had too many ideas. Now, in the company of a producer who just wanted to let things happen naturally, the freedom could have been disorienting. Berliner swears the singer's isolation booth was full of some kind of smoke. Berliner claims Morrison called it vegetable weed. But no one else has this exact recollection. "I don't know what he was doing in there," Davis says. "He's a strange fella." Perched on a stool, Morrison clutched his guitar, opened the binder of his new songs that Janet Planet had collated for him, and waited for Brooks Arthur to hit record. For the session musicians, this was just another gig, but for Morrison it must have felt like the last chance to breathe life into his faltering career. To be born again, as the title track proclaims. It is a point of contention whether lead sheets or chord charts were provided, but Davis believes Morrison just strummed the song and sang it from the booth once or twice, with the musicians improvising their parts on top of his composition minutes later. Tom Kilbanya claims he demonstrated some bass lines he had developed back in Boston for Davis. Davis denies this, but Payne confirms it. That a group of players who had been knee-deep in Ad Jingle Land hours before then pivoted to create the singularly beautiful music found on Astral Weeks seems incredible, but by all accounts this was actually the case. Guitarist Jay Berliner's schedule was so flanked by commercial work, in fact, he joked that he could have mistaken the session for another advertising job. Astral Weeks. I mean, what a long jingle, he says, laughing. And what are we selling here, exactly? Jingles are 30 seconds. Pop songs, about 3 minutes. But Morrison's new compositions called for takes that could stretch beyond 9 minutes. Kilbanya recalls that what ended up on the album was often an edit of a much longer jam. Jay Berliner finds this plausible and recalls Louis Marenstein at the control booth window smiling, rolling his hand in a keep-going motion. That first night they laid down Beside You, Cypress Avenue, and the epic Madame George, which hit the 5, 7, and 9 minute mark in their final versions. Everyone was so pleased with the results that they started to talk about trying one more before calling it quits. When John Payne heard it was going to be Astral Weeks, a song he had been playing with Van live back in Boston, he began to loudly campaign for permission to perform. "John was basically crying when I told him he wouldn't be on the album," Louis Marenstein recalls. "I said, 'It's not anything to do with your playing, it's just not the concept I had.'" Payne begged the hired flutist to let him borrow his instrument, as he had left his own at the Chelsea Hotel. "Oh, man, I just want to go home," the unknown musician replied, yawning. "Please," Payne said, with all the intensity of a young man recognizing the special opportunity before him. "Please let me play on this song." Marenstein and the weary flutist finally gave in, and John Payne took a seat inside the live room. The 22-year-old Harvard dropout and second cousin to poet Robert Lowell had just talked his way into a session with some of New York's best jazz musicians. "I was a cocky kid, I guess," Payne says. "I thought I was hot stuff. I was a little nervous, but mostly I was just excited because I had been playing with him and I knew I could do it." By all accounts, the song that appears on the album is the very first take. The interaction between Jay Berliner and me playing off each other and the whole way Van was just there listening to it was just amazing, Payne says. "I still think it's the best thing in the record. The first track." The unknown flutist, name lost to history, was not called back for the subsequent sessions. 6 days passed between this first session and the next. Somewhere on 9th Avenue, Warner Brothers' Joe Smith made the successful bag full of 20 grand drop-off to the sketchy associates of Bang Records. Also during this week, on the label's payroll, and with nothing better to do, John Payne and Tom Kilbanya took a personality test. Before they knew it, the two Bostonians found themselves taking a Scientology class, a new and quite apparently phony religion called Scientology is beginning to emerge from the lower depths, Women's Wear Daily reported a month before. In the United States, it is still basically unknown except to cultists and a few curiosity seekers. But in recent days, subway posters have appeared in New York urging everyone, step into the world of the totally free. Kilbanya remembers doing all the stuff where you stare into people's eyes for 2 hours straight and try to change their emotions. Kilbanya thought there might be something to it, but at $1,500 for a 6-week course, the price was too steep. Van Morrison wouldn't dabble in Scientology until the 80s. He thanked founder L. Ron Hubbard in the liner notes to 1983's Inarticulate Speech of the Heart, but already had a deep interest in occult writing. Van had a friend in high school who was a librarian in Belfast, Kilbanya says. This guy had all the occult books. This guy used to read them all, and he went insane. So Van was always kind of interested in that. That fall in New York, Morrison and Kilbanya hit every occult bookstore, hunting for a particular title Van wanted, Secret of the Andes, about flying saucers and people coming to visit this planet. Once they found it, they dove in. Written by George Hunt Williamson under the pseudonym Brother Philip, this 1961 text reads like a welcome packet for visitors to our planet. Its contents largely transmitted to Williamson via Ouija board. The Earth is a classroom for gods, but a strange classroom indeed. Some of the people of the more magnificent worlds are actually envious, because they know that on Earth, if you can combat such negativity, you have to be a powerful spirit. As in Lou Reed's preferred occult book, Alice Bailey's A Treatise on White Magic, 1934, the seven rays are also discussed here. Even more curiously, Brother Philip describes visitors to Earth he calls astrals. The astral forces are helping too. There are many great beings who are assisting both spacemen and yourselves. They are acting as emissaries, doing what work they can. Some of them perform fine services on the battlefields, on the streets, and in the offices, each acting as mentors and guides to the people of the world. After all, we have all been astrals many times. We have been astrals as many times as we have been mortals in that sense. Morrison had definitely written Astral Weeks by the time he and Kilbanya got hold of this book. And the phrase itself had come to him even earlier, back in Belfast, where it popped into his head while staring at a painting by his friend Cecil McCarthy. The words suggest a time and a place. They roll off the tongue like an incantation. Some long-lost relative of abracadabra or hocus-pocus, slowly forgotten over centuries. There were several paintings in the studio at the time, McCarthy explained. Van looked at the painting, and it suggested astral traveling to him. The painting was new, but for Morrison, the concept of an astral plane was not. In the 70s, he told interviewers about strange incidents he experienced as a child, lying in bed with the feeling that I'm floating near the ceiling looking down, and other amazing projections. His out-of-body experiences as a boy help explain the obsession with youth that runs through astral weeks. In these songs, the singer longs to return to an age when the world functioned like magic. And I will never grow so old again, he sings on the triumphant Yeatsian Sweet Thing. In Beside You, we meet little Jimmy and a barefoot virgin child. In the epic Cypress Avenue, the longing for youth takes on a more troubling form, what seems to be an adult yearning for a 14-year-old girl. The whole dreamlike plot of Madame George is filtered through a childlike vision leaping into view. Is it unusual for someone in his early 20s to already be so nostalgic for and obsessed with his youth? Around this time, Van Morrison gave Tom Kilbanya a kind of clue. He was an only child. That bothered him, Kilbanya says. We were in some hotel room just talking, and he said, "You know, people shouldn't be allowed to just have one kid, because you miss out on a whole bunch of stuff." Kilbanya, also without siblings, could relate. He thought that it was a terrible thing that happened to him. But writing Astral Weeks's lyrics wasn't necessarily so deliberate. Indeed, it might have been the opposite. Fast forward to 1986's No Guru, No Method, No Teacher, in which Morrison surprisingly echoed some of the imagery and phrasing from his breakthrough LP from 1968. The childlike vision returns, as does the garden wet with rain of Sweet Thing. On the No Guru song, Tiernanog, a reference to an Irish myth about a land that delivers everlasting youth, Morrison again sings about someone kissing his eyes, as he does on Astral Weeks. "Could you find me? Would you kiss my eyes?" The words suggest some kind of previously arranged secret code, a way for two lovers to recognize each other in the next life. When Morrison was asked how he wrote the newer song, In the Garden, he answered, "Oh yeah, I didn't write that. I was sitting in my flat one night and this voice said to me, 'Write this down,' and I pulled out the paper and I just wrote down what he told me, and that was the song." Whether you find any validity in this kind of claim, what is certain is that Morrison himself believes some of his songs arrived fully formed, via a kind of automatic writing. Janet Planet insists that Van's writing style, circa 1968, involved a stream-of-consciousness transmission that he would record and edit down after playback. Had Morrison arrived in Boston 80 years earlier, his new songs might have been studied by William James and the American Society for Psychical Research, rather than reviewed in Rolling Stone. As he told writer Richie York in 1979, "I didn't know what some of the stuff on Astral Weeks was about until years later. If the spirit comes through in a Madame George type of song, that's what the spirit says. You have very little to do with it. You're like an instrument for what's coming through." The next recording session, early on the morning of October 1st, went poorly. No one was feeling it. And after 3 hours of an undefinable tension, Merenstein sent everyone home. Timing is everything, not only in the scheduling of a session, but in the building block sense. Music is made up of countless choices of timing. This becomes readily apparent when listening to the alternate takes on 2015's expanded Astral Weeks release. In take 4 of Madame George and take 1 of Beside You, Morrison makes subtle changes in phrasing and lyrics and chooses different words to repeat over and over like a mantra, drastically altering the feel of the songs. After being so intimately familiar with the takes that make up the iconic 1968 release, hearing these recordings evokes an alternate reality in which these classics have yet to be set in stone. It's as if Morrison is in the same boat as the musicians who had just heard the songs moments before Merenstein hit record. 2 weeks passed before the third and final recording session on October 15th. Not only did the musicians have to nail the remaining songs, but in Merenstein's quest to find something appropriate to place at the end of the record, the group ran through Royalty and Going Around with Jesse James, two stray numbers pulled from Janet's binder. No one liked them, so Morrison kept flipping through, finally landing on an austere set of lyrics for a song that wasn't even familiar to the Boston musicians. "I used Slim Slow Slider to make it work," Merenstein says. about the album's haunting last chapter, "Make It Fade Into the Mystic." The whole band played the first take. Then Merenstein called everyone into the control room, leaving Van, Davis, and Payne, now